This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Aaron Chan.
Macro Voices episode 39 was recorded on November 10th, 2016. I'm Eric Townsend. We have a special post-election program for you today, as investors' eyes have all turned to what a Trump presidency will mean for financial markets. We set out to find the very best expert on both politics and financial markets, and we ended up finding two such experts. Dr. Harold Malmgren served in the official capacity of advisor to four U.S. presidents and unofficially to a couple of others, starting with the Kennedy administration. His daughter, Dr. Pippa Malmgren, followed in his footsteps as advisor to Presidents Reagan and George W. Bush, and also served on the President's Working Committee on Financial Markets, much more infamously known to many as the Plunge Protection Team. This interview ran considerably over our usual time budget, but the content was just too interesting to cut it off early. So we're going to keep our market wrap a little bit tighter this week and try to tighten up the show in order to keep the overall length under control.
And I'm Aaron Chan. Eric, on election day at 8:44 a.m., exactly, you tweeted, "Brexit deja vu. Markets acting like Clinton win is a done deal. Not smart. This thing ain't over till it's over." Well, needless to say, that tweet was spot on.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. But frankly, I feel like I really blew the call because I was convinced that if we saw this outcome of an upset victory by Donald Trump, which I explained last week, I thought was actually a lot more likely than other people thought. I thought for sure that the Hillary campaign would challenge the results, blame it on Russian hackers or whatever. And I have to say, as much as I'm personally not that big of a fan of Secretary Clinton, she was very professional and conceding defeat in what I thought was a very mature and eloquent way. So I've got to give her credit for that one. And it also did not surprise me that equities retraced. You know, there was a panic just like Brexit. Oh my God, the world is ending. It's not what we thought because markets hate when there is uncertainty. But, you know, this prediction that a Donald Trump presidency is going to lead to an 80% market crash in the first 2 days turned out to be nonsense. We've retraced to the point where we're trading well above those prices. And I think that that's mostly a reaction to spiking inflation expectations as people think that Trump's policies pertaining to trade tariffs and so forth will be inflationary.
Indeed, equity markets not only didn't crash like so many people predicted they would on a Trump win, but we're actually trading higher now than before the election, with E-mini S&P futures trading as high as 2180 in the overnight futures session and closing Thursday afternoon around 2163. So what's next for stocks?
Well, the next big test would be a close above 2191, which was the previous high, and I think we'll probably get that. Whether they're right or not, it seems like the initial market reaction is Trump presidency, very inflationary, and that is basically resulting in people abandoning treasury bonds and moving more aggressively into equities. And I think, you know, even Carl Icahn, who's been extremely bearish and concerned about the market, said that he went, he left Donald Trump's victory party early so he could go buy $1 billion in net notional exposure to equities in the overnight futures market. So this has so far been taken as a pretty bullish thing, and definitely it seems that the sentiment about, well, if Trump wins, that means we're going to have a market crash, seems like everybody conveniently forgot that.
Well, before we move on to crude oil, let's start with the U.S. dollar index. We traded on a 99 handle earlier today, and we're looking at a 98.87 around 4 p.m. on Thursday. Is the rally back on here?
Yeah, I definitely think that it is back on. And, you know, all, as I said last week, I don't think that it ever made sense to think that a Trump presidency was negative for the dollar. The possibility of a contested election result, I think, was the main reason that we saw so much weakness in the dollar in the run-up. And now that it's a done deal and nobody's contesting the election, I think the rally is very much back on in earnest. We had an opportunity on election night to buy the dollar index on a 95 handle, I think. 95.90 was the low print there, and we're already back up to almost 99. I think that the next big test will be 103 with the previous high, and then 110 comes into view after that. So I think it's up and away from here for the U.S. dollar.
Well, crude oil looks to be treading water this week, still trading on a $44 handle. Hardly a change from last week. So what's new in the oil patch this week?
Well, inventory-wise, we did see a 2.4 million barrel build on inventory, so the oil is piling up on a national basis. But Cushing, Oklahoma, which is the critical choke point for the West Texas Intermediate Crude Oil Futures contract, only saw a 28,000 barrel build, basically de minimis. Meanwhile, those builds on national inventory of 2.4 million sounds like a pretty big number to the upside in terms of inventory, but gasoline and distillates both drew down dramatically. Gasoline, 2.8 million barrel drawdown. Distillates, 1.9 million barrel drawdown. Collectively, the size of the drawdown in finished products is considerably bigger than the total size of the build. Notably, though, production was up again this week as the rig count continues to rise. I still think that lower prices are coming, certainly a test of 42.50, if not lower. As far as whether it gets much lower, the inventory numbers are going to tell us. I do note this week that the time spreads are widening considerably, which means that people are expecting the possibility of lower prices. And a lot of traders will tell you that widening contango, widening time spreads, is oftentimes a predictor of lower prices still to come.
Well, gold traded as high as 1338 on election night, but surprised a lot of us by reversing pretty dramatically after the election results were in, with a low print so far of 1251 earlier on Thursday, and closing around 1256 as we're taping the show.
Well, Stan Druckenmiller really surprised me, and I think got a lot of people's attention, when he told CNBC that he sold all of his gold on election night. And he's been an outspoken gold bull and obviously a very, very shrewd investor, famously astute investor. And he says that he really thinks that in the wake of this Trump presidency, what that's going to mean is inflation expectations picking up, and that causing massive flows out of safe haven assets like treasuries and gold into U.S. dollars. So he is again confirming the bullish view on the U.S. dollar, and he thinks that that will be negative for gold. The tape action is very much confirming that so far, seeing a lot of weakness in gold. So I think long term, I don't know that I'm completely sold that the argument that we've had for gold has been very strong. I do continue to look at any weakness in the gold market as buying opportunities, but maybe it's time here to wait this out and see if those buying opportunities get dramatically better from here.
So 10-year Treasury yields exploded this week, trading at around 2.10 on Thursday afternoon. What's the story here?
I think it's entirely about spiking inflation expectations in reaction to the election. Both Pippa and Harold Malmgren in our future interview are going to have more to say about that, so I don't want to steal their thunder. But I think that maybe the market is getting a little bit ahead of itself. It really begs a question then, is this that buy the dip moment that Raoul Paul alluded to, where we get north of 2% yields? Maybe it's time to buy treasuries, expecting those sub 1% yields that Raoul thinks are still coming? Or is it time to say, wait a minute, in spiking inflation expectations, that changes the game. Maybe Jeff Gundlach is really right and the bottom is in for yields and it's all uphill from here. That's the question to ask for sure. I don't know what the answer is. I'm still on the sidelines.
Great. Thanks for the market update, Eric. Doctors Harold and Pippa Malmgren hardly need any introduction, both having served as economic advisors to multiple U.S. presidents. Eric's interview with the Malmgrens is coming up as Macro Voices continues, right here at macrovoices.com.
And now, with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Throughout history, there have been father-daughter teams for just about everything, whether it's running a restaurant or another family business. But if we talk about advising multiple United States presidents, as well as prime ministers and senior officials from around the world, Doctors Harold and Pippa Malmgren are for sure the world's only father-daughter team that both have experience advising multiple presidents. Normally, we don't get into a lot of introduction time in this program, but since both of you have a political background that some of our financial audience may not be familiar with, could I ask both of you, starting with Harold, to give just a brief introduction to your background?
Well, I was an academic when I was asked to come to Washington with Jack Kennedy. And at that time, the first thing I did was work in the Pentagon. And then I was kept by Lyndon Johnson and given a lot of responsibility. And then I left, and then Nixon brought me back saying he had a lot of trouble with the Senate because I'd been advisor of the Senate Finance Committee in the interim. And I was popular in the Senate. And then Jerry Ford asked me to stick around. So since then, I was asked by two other presidents, one Republican, one Democrat, to come back into the cabinet. But in the later years, I declined because I was busy working with leaders in a number of other countries, and I was having fun being on my own without having to worry about the political consequences. But I spent a lot of time also on advising sovereign wealth funds and some of the bigger ones around the world, and quite a few banks and several corporations on how the world was changing and affecting where they locate and how they manage their finances. So it's a kind of very broad background, but with an eye always to the politics, not only in the U.S., but elsewhere.
And Dr. Pippa.
Yeah, well, I had my dad to begin with, which was a huge advantage in the start of my career because he taught me that economics was such a fun, interesting subject, and it got me interested in getting into politics. So I had my first job was working for Ronald Reagan during the time that they were doing the Plaza Agreement with the dollar and doing the beginning of the Uruguay round. So I was just a kid and a White House intern, but that's where I started. And then I worked in financial markets, but I kind of became the person that explained the markets to the policymakers and the policymakers to the markets because the two sides don't understand each other very well. So I ended up being the chief currency strategist for a couple of the big banks. And from that, I was invited to be the president's advisor in the White House on all financial market issues under George W. Bush. I was on the National Economic Council, the president's working group on financial markets, famously known as the Plunge Protection Team for all the conspiracy theorists out there. And then I worked on all the big issues like Enron and seven of the nine largest bankruptcies in American history. And I worked on terrorism risk to the economy after 9/11. And then since I advise mainly big institutional investors, but I also advise governments about what's happening on the landscape that's going to move prices. And particularly my focus is on the risks you can't quantify. So politics, policy, and geopolitics and how they're going to move markets.
Fantastic. Obviously, the topic of discussion for today is going to be what the Trump presidency will mean to investors in financial markets. But before we dive into the financial implications of this, I want to start with just the bigger picture of the Trump presidency. Obviously, President-elect Trump had a very strong message in his campaign. That strong message was essentially that all of the people that he now has to work with are corrupt and shouldn't be trusted. So he didn't make a whole lot of friends along the way on the campaign trail. How effective can he be? We do have now a White House and a Congress that are both controlled by the same party, which would normally be, you know, very good for collaboration and cooperation. Do you think President Trump will be able to pull it off, or do you think there's going to be a lot of divisiveness in the party because of how contentious this campaign has been?
Yeah, I think on that, the Republicans are now going to savor the fact that they've got now control of the agenda. So there's one rump group in the lower house, our House of Representatives, named the House Freedom Caucus. There are about 40 members. And in the last year or two or three, they've been obstructive about everything. And but I think now that they see that they're going to be in the middle of a dominant political agenda, they'll probably cooperate, at least for a while. And the enemies, well, he's made enemies with a lot of people, but none of those enemies are going to be in the new administration. What he's basically done is cleared the decks in order to bring in an entirely new establishment. And so you can say this is risky, but you can also say it's a chance to reset the entire apparatus of government in the United States with fresh people and no past agenda. So all of those conspiracies like the neocons will be swept aside, but we won't see any of those people in this new system. So I see it as a chance for a reset and an opportunity, but it depends on who he chooses.
And Pippa, anything to add?
I have to agree. So I think that, you know, one of the interesting things is people hated the language that he used, but they liked the principles that he represents, which is mainly, I'm going to attack the entire establishment, left, right, the media, the politics, the money, and he's going to use that language on all those people. So he's going to be at war. He basically is like a guy with a bulldozer. And he goes into the system and he just raises everything. And this is what people want because they realize that the government is broke. It's got its finances in a terrible mess. It's never going to be able to look after you. So if you want to look after yourself, then you want a world that has smaller government, lower taxes, less red tape. And in order to get there, he has to be outrageous in his attack on the system. But actually, so far, he's done it. So I'll give you just one example, which is the money side. I mean, they say now the average cost, the average price of his voters, what it cost him to win a single vote was $5. He basically only spent money on those red hats. He didn't spend any money on the ground game. He didn't spend any money on the team and the campaign. He spent nothing on pollsters, which was incredibly wise in retrospect, given how lousy their predictions were. But what that proves is you do not have to sell your soul anymore as an American politician in order to win the presidency. You can get there with no money whatsoever. And I think every lobbyist, every lawyer, every fundraiser in Washington is having a heart attack right now because they are out of business. And so first task already accomplished. And I think that is the world we're looking at. It's going to be a rough ride, but kind of somebody had to do it.
Okay. Now, we've had, obviously, just in the first 24 hours after the election result, which surprised a lot of people, we've seen riots. We've seen five people shot in Seattle. We've seen death threats against President-elect Trump. Is this a flash in the pan? Do you think that we're seeing the beginning of an escalation in divisiveness that's going to continue? You know, will it subside or will it escalate from here in terms of the reaction that we're seeing that's so angry by so many people? Harold?
It's been escalating now for a couple of years. So this is not new. It's been getting rougher and rougher. Police being shot directly has happened more frequently in the last several months. And President Obama, although he probably didn't intend to do it, he increased the divisiveness by trying to tell the nation that it's not surprising that the black community is upset. There's a long history. And so, in a sense, he gave a blessing through a certain amount of public dissent and disorder. That's not going to stop. That will be wound down slowly. But it was already in place. Now, for the time being, you've got people who are Trumpers and people who are Hillary people, and they'll be happy. But I've never seen Hillary people actually out doing things with guns and the riots, although they are pretty active in social movements. The Trumpers, you know, they're satisfied now. I mean, they'll quiet down and basically get behind the president for a while. And one thing that's really noticeable is the margin in the Electoral College was much stronger for Trump than it was for George W. Bush.
And Pepe, anything to add?
Yeah, so I agree with my dad that this trend towards more violence has been in place for a while. My personal view is that the real driver behind it is, first of all, a rise in the cost of living. Now, that's super controversial to say because the Fed says there's absolutely no increase in inflation. But even if you look at the official numbers, we've gone from practically no inflation to hitting the central bank's target, which is 2%. And Janet Yellen's already said, well, then let's raise the target. Let's make it higher. So I think inflation is in play. And if you're poor, you feel that when your rent goes up, when your cost of groceries go up, when protein prices go up. And so I think people were already angry and feeling pain from that pressure. Trump has said, I want the Fed to print money. And while he can't throw Janet Yellen out, she's protected technically, the guy's a landlord, right? He knows how to make a tenant uncomfortable and push them out of the building. So I suspect that that's what's going to happen. And we are going to end up with a Federal Reserve leadership that says, yeah, let's hit the printing pedal. And in that environment, we can expect more inflation. And that will, again, hurt the poor. So we really need to think about the social consequences of any decision to inflate more. So I think that's a critical issue. The other thing is just the divide between those with assets and those without, the split between the rich and the poor. It's so wide, and the avenues for the poor to improve their situation are so limited that it has to express itself one way or another: anger, pain, protest. So hopefully what Trump can do is deliver the hope, the possibility that the avenue for a regular person who has no money, no connections, just talent or hard work and pure grit has a chance to make it, which has traditionally been the American story. So he's just about, if he can return us to that past environment where you could get ahead on your own hard work, I think it'll diminish the need for people to protest their way out of it.
But there's one thing that it's politically incorrect to say, but the Federal Reserve policies basically increased the wealth of those people who had large holdings of assets, you know, property and stocks and commodities. But when you tell the story of the U.S. economy, there are really two stories. There's the Fed story and the president's story, which is the economy's been growing since the great financial crisis. It's better now than it was. It's safer than it was. But then if you say, well, wait a minute, if we set aside the top 5%, including the wealthiest, plus doctors, lawyers, scientists, and supervisors, and just take the 95% of the people in the streets, what is the situation? Well, when you break out the 95%, the median income has been going down since the president started. And when you go through it, you get two groups. One group is no better off, and then a large, large group, which is much worse off. Now, what happened? There was a new thing that happened that I've been predicting for months, and that was that healthcare insurance costs would go up dramatically just about election time. And in fact, the insurers throughout the country sent out letters which arrived on people's doorstep 4 or 5 days before the election, saying, by the way, beginning November 1, your premiums are going to be increased by 30, 40, 50% per month. And, oh, yes, by the way, what you're going to have to spend out of pocket in order to qualify for a relief is going to be tripled or quadrupled. So that was one big thing, because incomes for most people have not been rising. So if you say to somebody, by the way, we're going to take a bigger bite for healthcare, that was a heavy hit. And second, all the young people are moving towards renting rather than buying homes, and the rent costs are going up dramatically. So when you start looking at the 95%, basically, you can say they're worse off now than they were, and the older people cannot say that their children are going to have a better life ahead. They're now thinking they're going to have a worse life, and even worse, they're going to be home here in the house because they can't afford to live outside. That's been building up for some time.
As we turn to financial markets, I want to go back to this theme of inflation, because certainly as we look at the charts, there have been a massive spike in inflation expectations since the election result. And I think it's pretty clear that people think that President-elect Trump's policy statements around imposing tariffs and so forth, people see those as inflationary. And of course, bonds are already dumping on this. And I can't help but wonder, boy, you know, I personally have held the view for a long time that we're kind of in a bond market bubble that needs a catalyst to pop it at some point. And I've always wondered what that catalyst would be. I wonder if this sudden spike in inflation expectations is the beginning of something much bigger, and if it could potentially lead to, you know, a dramatic sell-off in the bond market. So I guess starting with bonds, but also looking at stocks and other financial assets, precious metals and so forth, I'd love to get both of your views on what presidency of Donald Trump is going to mean for financial markets. Harold, do you want to start?
Yeah, I think everybody in the market in the last, 3 days is jumping to the conclusion that everything Trump will do will be inflationary. And that may be true, but I think everybody's jumping the gun. First of all, it takes a long time to set up a new administration. And second, he hasn't really said explicitly what he's going to do about anything. He's been broad brushed. He's raised issues that everybody's excited about and concerned with. But how he would proceed is a whole other question. And then there's the issue of what power does he have? He cannot change taxes without the Congress passing tax legislation. And that takes a process of consultation with not only all the businesses, but the Catholic Church and the charities, the Boy Scouts. Everybody in America gets involved with tax reform. And it normally takes 9 months to 18 months to write tax law. And then can he raise duty? Can he put obstacles up for trade with China? He doesn't have power. The Constitution, strangely enough, says that only the Congress has authority over trade. And so he has zero power. He can ask the Congress to do something, but the Congress will then divide between the people who want to hammer China and the people who sell to China. I mean, the companies that are selling a lot of stuff in China, like General Motors, will be lobbying hard to do nothing. So probably there'll be an impasse for a while because the president himself doesn't have the power to do anything in trade. So then we start looking at what else can he do. Well, he can change health care, but again, he has to bring about a very detailed change in the law, and we're talking 1,000 or 2,000 pages of law. That's not going to happen overnight. So everybody's jumping the gun as to how this all plays out. Also, he'll bring in a new Treasury Secretary, and he will be working. Well, he is working already on whether the Fed should be restructured, have a different role, what the influence of the banks over the Fed should be. The idea is already, let's say, under discussion whether you should move all the bank supervision away from the Fed completely, so that the banks don't have a grip on policy, because right now the banks own the Fed. So all of that is in play. I think it's way early to that the market is overreacting, because I'll give you one example. If the European banking situation goes into a mess this winter, which is, I think, highly likely, a lot of money is going to flow to the U.S. And I think the dollar is going to get stronger. And during that time, there will be crises also as the dollar gets stronger in the emerging markets in China, because there are so many of these countries have been borrowing in dollars in the last 3 years. So you've got about $10 trillion of foreign borrowing in dollars. And now what you're seeing, it's not so visible yet, is dollar shortage all over the world. And so black markets are beginning to appear in a number of countries. So all of that's going to play out too. So I think, yes, inflation is coming eventually, but is it now or is it 3-4 years from now? I think that's a really uncertain question to answer.
And Pippa, your view?
Yeah, I'm also not as worried about this issue of a bond market sell-off because, well, so many different reasons. One is if the yield goes up on U.S. bonds, frankly, the rest of the world would love to buy that. People just don't like to buy a falling knife. But if they think that the yields are going to have an adjustment and then settle down, that's buyable. Second, like I said, people are really interested in investing in the United States. They see the U.S. as the fastest growing industrialized economy in the world. Probably the most dynamic location on the planet is the Mexico-Texas Midwest corridor today. And they are definitely putting capital to work there. And if Trump opens up infrastructure to foreign investment, which I think he will, and get foreigners to finance our new airports, our new physical infrastructure, then actually you won't be blowing out the budget. And therefore, the pressure on the bond market's not so great. Also, he said he wants to cut expenditure on lots of things, like, you know, the famous line that he wants to kill the Environmental Protection Agency. Well, probably isn't going to be able to completely shut it down. I mean, we need rules of some kind. But he could really radically change the budget and reduce it and in a way that would leave money for other things. So we don't know yet. But we do know that actually the global appetite for more fiscal policy is a lot higher today than it has been in the past. So I'm not sure you're going to get that bond market vigilante response because, frankly, people have forgotten about inflation. They're like, we should be so lucky as to get some. They have just no memory of what it's like when you can't control it. So probably inflation would have to go substantially higher before you get back to a world where bond market vigilantes have any role to play.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think we may see the yields on the longer maturity treasuries go back down some distance because I think the demand for dollars is going to be so strong. You know, there are a lot of people now pointing out that the Chinese are selling off treasuries. Well, you know, that's sort of half true because Chinese are also big buyers each time there's a treasury auction. Why the Chinese are selling off is they're running out of dollars. And a lot of the state enterprises and businesses have been borrowing in dollars the last 3 years. And now they got to find a way to pay off those dollars. They don't have enough dollar cash. So there are temporary factors in play that everybody's overlooking. So I think we're going to see terrible problems in other countries. We're going to see currencies fall in many places. Dollar will get stronger. And if you're a hedge fund in Europe, you're going to position yourself in dollars and get out of euros and out of a lot of other currencies because you're going to make money just from the capital gain. And so if you buy treasuries with a reasonably decent yield, way higher than Europe, and you also got a rising currency, it's a no-brainer. So dollars are going to become – treasuries are going to become more attractive once trouble hits everywhere else.
Totally agree.
So it sounds like both of you think that the market is jumping prematurely to conclusions about inflation. With respect to the bigger picture, though, of just your outlook for various financial markets, do you have one yet, or do you think that we have to wait and see in terms of how this presidency goes before you can form a meaningful opinion on where markets might be headed as a result of this?
I don't know. I think it's pretty clear that equity markets are going to go up on this overall story of smaller government, lower taxes, less red tape, more accommodating environment. I agree with my dad. I think Europe is coming into a period of some turbulence. I've just spent 3 days in Italy. I met with the recent former head of the Italian Constitutional Court. I think the Italians are going to say no to this next referendum on December the 4th. The whole world is going to go, oh my God, they're not going to pursue reform. There's no solution. The markets will attack the Italian banking system again. Some of those institutions like, the famous Banco Monte dei Paschi have already lost like 98% of their share value. And there's no way to do a bailout. And I think they can lose 98% more of their share value. We're going to have a series of crises around financial institutions. We've already seen two of the biggest German banks are in the headlines all the time on this same question of what's the condition of their finances. In that world, people are looking to the U.S. as a safe haven. I also think there are developments in other parts of the world, like China, that we've maybe missed because we're so focused on the Trump stuff. Like last week, the Politburo in China announced that Xi Jinping has been elevated to what they call core status. Only two other people in modern history have been given this, Mao and Deng Xiaoping. And what it basically means is it's one guy in charge now. He won't be challenged ever again. He's permanently there until the end of his life. And personally, I have questions about, can China innovate in that more one-man rule kind of environment? Is there enough creativity and oxygen for that in that situation? Maybe not. And if that's the case, again, they're going to look to other places. Personally, I think Mexico is the new China. Its wages are 20% cheaper than China. It's deeply integrated to the U.S. And again, to your point, the markets are selling off China Mexico way prematurely on the assumption that somehow Trump is going to shut down economic activity across the border. I think this is absolutely a misreading of what he has said. And actually, American companies are moving south as quick as they can because high productivity, incredibly high quality control, better than China. And if there's more process around immigrants coming into America, but they aren't excluded from coming in, they just are pushed into legal channels, which he has already said he's going to make shorter and faster. Frankly, Mexico is going to be a buy story very shortly, and the U.S. generally as well. So I'm a bit optimistic on that one.
Harold, anything you want to add?
I agree with all of that. And I would add that, you know, to the extent that he wants to halt immigration for a while from Mexico, a lot of companies will say, fine, we'll just move the plants down there. I mean, it's going to be counterproductive because the U.S. needs that labor. And so if we can't bring it in, the production will simply go to where it is.
Okay. Let's move on to some more foreign policy subjects. Certainly, Vladimir Putin was very quick to congratulate Trump and has made it clear that he would welcome the opportunity to work with Trump to repair the condition of Russia's relationship with the United States. That sounds like a fantastic idea to me, but I wonder how effectively President Trump could do that, because there's been so much rhetoric in the United States that Putin's a bad guy. And, you know, if Trump is seen to be friendly with Putin, I think it probably damages him. How do you see this playing out? Can Trump save the day somehow and correct the relationship with Russia before it falls apart?
This is a really complicated subject, because what Putin would like to do is get the U.S. to recognize that the area that was the old Soviet Union, much of Eastern Europe, really is historically part of the realm of Russian influence. And so they would like the U.S. to say, okay, no, we're not going to expand eastward anymore, our military interest through NATO, and we're going to not be so, attentive to Eastern Europe. And that, of course, frightens Poland and the Baltic states and some of the countries to the south. So that would be his objective. So, and it depends on how the president would negotiate, because President Trump has said what he wants to do is lean on present NATO membership to either pay up some more for the protection of the West, or otherwise, there's no reason for the U.S. to keep putting money into protecting people who are getting a free ride, particularly about Germany. So how that's going to play out is we'll see. I don't think it's something that happens overnight. I think it's something that will be slowly negotiated, discussed over 3 or 4 years. It's something that may change over the duration of his first term as president, but not something that's going to change tomorrow morning. Too many different pieces of the puzzle are in play, both relations with U.S. with Europe and U.S. with Russia.
Pippa, anything to add on Russia?
Yeah, definitely. You know, I worked for President George W. Bush, and we all remember when he said, I've met Putin and looked him in the eyes, and this is a guy I can do business with. And then it turned out not so much. It was not such an easy thing to do business with him. Well, I suspect we may have the same thing with Trump, that he thinks, well, you know, I can negotiate with this guy. We see eye to eye. But in reality, Putin is pursuing what is in the national interest of Russia. And so, for example, when Trump has said Ukraine and Crimea, hey, look, we don't want it. You guys have it. If you want it, we certainly don't want it. Well, this may be true. It may be true that it's in the American national interest to step away from that issue. There are a lot of people who would say, my gosh, we fought hard for that in the Cold War. And so there's going to be a big debate about that. But I do think if I were Putin and they handed something valuable to me like that, if they said, oh, Syria, we don't really want that. If you want that, go for it. I would say, oh, this is great. I can pursue my national interests more aggressively. So I can't say we should be surprised if we see the Russians behaving in a much more aggressive way and expanding their reach at a time when they detect the Americans are not interested in, and creating a bit of a vacuum. As a small example, it looks like, you know, North Africa is becoming destabilized very quickly. The Saudis have just cut off the money for Egypt because they're running out of cash themselves. Libya is obviously held together by two threads. And there's worry about Algeria. Well, guess what we saw last week? The Russians held the first military exercises, I think, ever in North Africa near El Alamein. What are they doing in North Africa? Answer, well, it's a vacuum. So they step in. So I think that this issue is going to come back. The other one is the issue with the Chinese and the arguing about the South China Sea and who's legitimately allowed to be there. And I suspect that Trump is also going to face tricky issues in managing, because the Chinese are going to say, listen, we got to feed our people, and 10% of the world's fish supply is right there in the South China Sea, not to mention all the access for the shipping lanes that are so critical for a nation that can't feed itself and depends on bringing food back home and other raw materials as well. So I suspect foreign policy is going to get a little noisy. And everybody knows that Trump has said, I'm not interested in this issue and I don't want to deal with it. So that's an invitation for trouble a little bit.
Now, in addition to everything you just mentioned, of course, there's the oil and gas rights under the South China Sea, and that just adds to this. But a lot of Trump's critics have said, you know, this guy is going to start a trade war with China that's just not in our best interest. Do you think that's a legitimate criticism? Do you think that Trump starting a trade war over tariffs and import duties and so forth could potentially be the catalyst that causes an escalation of those other issues that you described with China?
Well, let's stop for a minute. Something I said to you earlier in passing, the Constitution, for whatever curious reasons of how it was drafted, says explicitly the Congress shall regulate foreign commerce. In other words, the president can do what he wants with diplomacy, but he has no power to alter trade policy. The House and the Senate have jealously guarded their authority. And this is why we get in these battles from time to time about delegation of authority to the president to negotiate. So what Trump can do is he can stop things like he can stop the famous Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement if he wants to, because that's not law yet. But he can't just impose new restrictions on China. He can, if he wants, play the game of unfair trade and increase anti-dumping duties and countervailing duties, but he can't impose new restrictions on his own. Now, if it goes to the Congress, there are going to be two interest groups. One is time to kick the Chinese in the butt, and then there is the other group that sells to China a lot of stuff, and where we have many companies in China that would be, let's say, put in jeopardy if we have a trade war. And we're not talking about minor companies. We're talking about GM and Google and a lot of other of the big parts of our economy. So there would be a debate. And he's a pragmatist. I think Trump would simply listen to all these different sides and say, this is more complicated than I thought. So I don't think it's easy for him to start a trade war with China, but he's scaring the Chinese, that's clear. So we'll see how that plays out. But I think that's a long game. He can't do it. He has no power to do it by himself. It's going to be publicly debated, and the lobbyists for the big companies are not going to like squeezing China very hard.
Pippa, anything to add on China?
Totally. I totally agree. You know, there's a phrase that gets used. There are China sluggers and China huggers, or panda huggers and panda sluggers. And this is the fight that's going to play out, as you say, Dad, between the folks who want things to go well with China and the people who want to be more confrontational. I think there's the same fight with regard to Russia, that there are people who say we got to be accommodating and that'll calm things down. And the people who say the only thing that works is a hard line. But one thing I'd point out is, you know, my dad went to Russia to Moscow back in the early 1970s with Henry Kissinger. They were sent by President Nixon to have a dialogue with the Russians at the height of mutual assured destruction, when, you know, nuclear weapons were all pointing at each other and we were pretty close to the brink at various times. Today, I think there is almost no dialogue between the United States and Russia. Certainly in official circles, it's unbelievably limited. And I think that we're more likely to have problems if we're not talking. I don't know, Dad. What do you think, based on your experience?
Yeah, I think exactly right, because I did have experience with the Russians. And indeed, after the collapse of the Soviet Union, I actually sat next to Putin when he was a deputy mayor of St. Petersburg. I sat next to him at quite a few dinners, so I actually know him. Now, when I say I know him, I mean I know him well enough to know that I would not want to be in a dark alley alone with him without somebody protecting me. But there is no dialogue now. That's correct. At the time, even in the worst of the Cold War, there was always a dialogue. And nobody pays attention to all of that. The Russians had an ambassador in Washington named Dobrynin, who was there throughout most of the Cold War. And I had many conversations with Dobrynin. Dobrynin also was always talking to Kissinger, but Dobrynin was in Moscow, a member of the Central Committee. So he was the unusual ambassador here, but had voice there. And there was always a dialogue. And we avoided lots of accidents. And we even managed to have arms control agreements from time to time, even though there was a lot of growling. Right now, there's absolutely nothing going on, and it's an atmosphere in which the militaries can easily have accidents between each other. There's no hotline, by the way. Now there's no for whatever reasons, our present president didn't want to continue with it. So we have the militaries there and the militaries in the United States want to have more dialogues just to avoid accidents that hurt some of their people unnecessarily. So, but once you start talking, the issues tend to calm down and get more focused and more defined. And once it's the way of international negotiations. If you can narrow things down to one step at a time and one issue at a time, it becomes manageable.
Before we move on from foreign policy, let's touch Mexico briefly. Obviously, President Trump's promises during his campaign were very bold. You know, build a wall, make Mexico pay for it, deport every single illegal immigrant and send them back. Do you think that those are just campaign rhetoric that's going to be forgotten, or do you think that he's going to follow through? And what will the knock-on effects and economic consequences be if he does? Harold?
Well, Pippa probably has thoughts, but as I said before, if you stop the flow, I mean, then Ford, GM, and Chrysler will simply build more cars south of the border. I mean, it's not going to happen. And if the flow is stopped, the labor costs inside the southern U.S. will be jumping up in California, Texas, and other places. But I don't think it'll happen quite that way. I mean, I think there'll be a dialogue. There's a lot to do between the two countries. And the president also can't change immigration laws so easily. I mean, the Congress has been involved with immigration quotas since 1920s, when in those days there was so much allotted for Ireland and so much for Italy, and it was negotiated all the time according to which companies needed which kind of workers. The laws are so deep, it's just that Obama was ignoring the laws. So I think when he sits down with people who are expert in this, they'll find many ways of handling what he wants to do. And the idea of a wall is going to be well down the list of priorities. But I'll give you an example of one thing that can be that is already under discussion, and that is the Coast Guard. The Coast Guard has been crippled and treated as a forlorn orphan that nobody cares about. And yet, probably most of the problems, including drug movements, are the realm of the Coast Guard. So there is some of the Trump people are already talking about, well, what can we do about bringing the Coast Guard back into relevance? Because the water is probably the biggest problem. So that's already underway. I'm not so gloomy about the thinking that's going on. I think it's going to be how the president delegates this, and then probably where he has to begin is a major revamp of Homeland Security, which is full of dead weight created by the last administration to favor open borders, and the morale got really low, and anybody who really cared basically retired or just took shorter days and played more golf.
Yeah, I kind of have also an interesting different view on Mexico. You know, I did the live coverage of the debates with one of the big international television channels here out of London, where I'm based, Sky News. And it was so interesting. Trump was very careful when he said that, you know, the wall goes up, but I want to create a situation where people with talent and skills and experience can come into the U.S. to deploy it, and that people who don't have that, you know, can actually get through the legal hurdles more quickly, with greater certainty. And I think that this message is very, very powerful, and it was under noticed by the markets. And like I said, Mexico, bottom line is that it is a very dynamic economy. The Chinese are investing a ton of money in Mexican infrastructure, from physical railways all the way to building new refineries. I mean, the word is that they're going to build 5 new oil refineries about literally 2.5 inches off the U.S. border. And why? Because the Environmental Protection Agency didn't permit the building of a new refinery for the last, I think it's 32 years last time I looked. So the Mexicans have said, fine, we'll build them. It's a 34, thank you. So the Mexicans have said, okay, we'll build them. The Chinese said, we'd be delighted to fund that, because what we want to do is take all that crude out of the Gulf of Mexico and bring it back to China. And technology permits this now. What used to be really messy and difficult to deal with, yeah, now technology makes it easy to pull that stuff out of the Gulf of Mexico. All that is a buy story. I agree as well, by the way, the legalization of marijuana in the United States, which is gaining momentum like crazy. It's super popular with everyone for obvious reasons. Some not so obvious. Mainly governments are doing it at the state level because they're broke. And if you make it legal, you can tax it. It's a revenue generating measure. It's not like their morals all changed. It's that their pocketbook needs the cash. And as those states start to do that, it'll make the whole relationship between Mexico and the U.S. over the drug trafficking issue potentially easier to manage. Everybody will have to spend less on enforcement. They'll have more capital spent on other things. And so it's up to you to decide. Do you think if you legalize marijuana, you open the door to, you know, much harder drugs that are even more difficult to police? Or do you think once you legalize marijuana, it diminishes the use of drugs generally, including the hard stuff? It's an open question, but I think that overall, it looks like the drug trafficking issue gets diminished if both sides start to say it's legal. And the Mexicans have said, as soon as California says it's legal, we're going with them.
Let's take a step back now from these specific issues around the Trump presidency and focus on what I think may be even a more interesting story, which is the bigger picture of the rise of populism. You know, first it was Brexit that everybody thought was impossible, but the people didn't do what the elites wanted them to do. They did what they wanted. Next, President Trump, you know, totally unexpected by most. All the pollsters got it wrong. The Italian referendum could be next. So what is driving this big rise in populism around the globe, and where is it likely headed from here? Harold?
Yeah, well, we could both talk about this, because regarding Italy, for example, Pippa was just there and deeply involved in a discussion about that referendum. But this populism, it can be found in many countries. I mean, there are some that's not. Japan is still sort of semi-asleep about this type of issue. But it's a growing issue throughout Europe. It has similar dimensions to the U.S., but worse. Europe is aging, and it has a huge social support system it can't really support. as the population ages, because the labor base is shrinking relatively to the number of people that have to be paid for. But the policies of European governments have been so harsh on ordinary people, and like the U.S., favoring the banks and the wealthy, that the population is basically confronting the same widening wealth gap, and they're rebelling. So we're going to see not only the UK talking exit, but the pressures for the two things that are going to happen in Europe. One is pressures for exit in other countries, Greece maybe again. Netherlands is seriously considering a shift in that direction. France depends on the dynamics of the coming election in this next year, but they're going to be more, let's say, less Euro-friendly and more in favor of greater nationalism. Then you've got Donald Tusk, who was president of what's called the European Council, which is the leadership of all the countries, and who's saying basically when you count in all of the Eastern Europe and the smaller countries, what we want is less making of laws by bureaucrats in Brussels and more democratic processes with greater delegation back to the national governments of regulation of many things that Brussels had taken over. And that's going to be a growing issue throughout 2017. It will affect also, for example, in Spain, Catalonia wants to break loose and get free of the everything to do with Brussels, and because that's where all the money and business is. They want freedom from get out from under all that regulation. So it's a similar process, widening income gap, everybody's stuck, no progress, and then, of course, on top of all of this, very slow world growth. And the one thing which I spent decades on in government was trade, and I've been saying now for several years, since the great financial crisis, world trade has been slowing down, and now this year basically showing signs of contraction, even in volume, not just value. Now, what this means is that a heck of a lot of countries around the world managed to find ways to grow, even though they had weak domestic consumption, by selling stuff to other countries. They use external demand to drive. Now, how many countries are we talking about? More than 100. And of these, Germany, for example, is the most export-dependent country in the world. Hardly anybody pays attention to that. I think Germany's economy is set to start shrinking because there is no growth in world trade now. And without growth in world trade, there's no driver for growth in Germany. And then they've got the old age population. So all of these things are at work. So this rising populism is unhappiness that average people are not better off, they're worse off. And it looks like they're going to be even more worse off. And this is before we even talk about inflation in the next few years. So it's a growing global problem. It has a lot to do with slowdown in global growth, collapse of world trade. It's a kind of that we're going to see a period of deglobalization, not because people choose to it, but because it's happening. And there'll be more regional arrangements like U.S.-Mexico. But it's a kind of, we're going to go through a couple of decades anyway of recalibration of societies. And in the meantime, unhappy publics that want change, and they want change, which means greater autonomy at the local level. And I think we're going to see it in the U.S. too, by the way. I think we're going to see more and more pressure to delegate back to the states and back to local communities a lot of things, because we're just getting overregulated at the national level.
Yeah, I have to agree with you on most of that. I'd take it even further, though, and say, you know, what's at the heart of the whole populist uprising is, number one, everybody is discontented. It's not just that a few people or one part of society, even the people who are really, really well off, are feeling nervous that all the wealth has ended up in such a small number of hands and that somehow this is rendering our societies less stable. I wrote a book this last year called Signals. And one of the core ideas in it was that there's always a social contract between governments and their citizens. It's always a deal. And, you know, you agree to pay your taxes and abide by the law. And in exchange, you expect government to deliver certain things like, you know, roads without potholes, education to a certain level, a justice system that you can trust. There are lots of things, you know, a fire department that arrives when you call the number. And what's happening today is the debt burden is so huge that it's causing governments to be unable to deliver on their promises. You know, they promised you could retire at, 65. Now they come back and say, well, yeah, maybe like 93, you know, given the state of our finances. And people are mad about government defaulting on those promises and the inability to follow through. So you're getting a populist uprising. Let's also keep in mind that actually the public has been incredibly patient because the financial crisis was in 2008, and they were told if they just tightened the belt and just gave it a little time, government policy would fix all this stuff. Well, here we are years later, and they tightened the belt and they waited, and things are not materially better. I mean, you can hardly call the growth we have in the United States today a home run. It's better than it was, but it's certainly pretty paltry compared to what you'd hope for, especially given the resources that have been thrown into this thing. And so now people are saying, enough, enough of all that. You know, I want to rejig this whole thing. And they're basically asking two questions. One is, why is the wealth in my society being distributed to some other guy and not to me, right? Why am I not a beneficiary of all this? And number two, how come you people are in charge? I would like my own people in charge. And that explains Brexit. It explains Trump. It explains the protests that we're seeing in Europe and the rise of the further exit movements there, which all have their own names. You know, in Sweden, they call it Swexit. In Denmark, they call it Dagsit. In Italy, they even have the name. It's so funny. They can call it Itaxit, which is deeply ironic since that's their problem. But at any rate, everywhere, people are saying enough. And I think this is the essence of the populist movement. The good news about the populism is it doesn't seem to be saying it has a particular outcome that it wants it in respect to being on the left or on the right. People are basically saying, I want a version of capitalism that works for me. And that's what needs to be delivered. Now, whether that comes as a socialist answer in some parts of the world or a capitalist answer in other parts of the world, that's a local issue. But overall, people just want to come up with a system that works. So yeah, populism is a tough subject markets are having to adjust to. But I think in the end, what we're not going to end up with is a French Revolution. The system will be able to adapt. The ballot box will do the job it's supposed to do and take the pain. And if Trump doesn't work, they'll do it again. And after all, they voted Obama in on a change mandate. He didn't work. They chucked him out. Now they've thrown Trump in. If he doesn't work, they'll chuck him out and start again. So I'm optimistic about the flexibility of our political system to adapt to the populist forces.
I would add to that just a quick comment. I agree with that. There's been a collapse of confidence in societies, not only in how the governments function and the way in which nothing's been improving lately, but now, you know, it's really dramatized by this election where all the pollsters got everything wrong and the media, mainstream media had everything played one way and it came out differently. I think there's also a collapse of confidence in the fourth estate. There's a collapse of confidence in basically all the news, and slowly increasing attention to alternative media. I think we're going to find that new forms of news management are going to gradually develop where you get more objectivity and less news that's harnessed to particular interest groups. And another aspect of this is we have in every country a policy community that is known as the elites. You know, they're the people who have experience. They've been around a long time. These are the people who really know. But the reality is they have gone off on the wrong track. A lot of what the Fed has been doing is liked by other people who have been at the Fed or wish to be at the Fed. But the reality is Fed policy has gone way off track and has been, in the last 10 years, a failed experiment. So we're going to see some efforts to rebuild confidence, but it takes time. So right now there's growing disbelief. Whatever I hear, I don't believe it anyway. And people don't believe in the government figures. They don't believe in how decisions are made. Everybody thinks there must be some conspiracy. There's no way to explain the mess unless somebody's behind it. But the reality is it is a mess. So the transition won't happen fast. This is going to take a decade or two. But the existing institutions are simply not trusted any longer. And we're going to see a lot of fresh thinking that does get publicity.
We've only got a couple of minutes left, but I just want to push back quickly, Pippa, on your comments about this breakdown of the social contract, because I just can't help but observe, if you think it's bad now, just wait for what's coming, because holy cow, we have a social security system and an entitlement system in the United States, which is just unfunded. It is mathematically impossible to keep this Ponzi scheme going indefinitely. If you look at the social welfare system in Europe, it's largely been financed by deficit spending, more and more growing of this mountain of government debt. And if you're right, and inflation is about to rear its ugly head again, that means that the cost of all this government borrowing is going to go up dramatically. So there's going to be, I would think, a dramatic increase in the rate at which governments fail to deliver on the social contract. Does that mean that we're headed towards a huge amount of unrest, or do you think that this is somehow resolved, or do you think that I've got the economics wrong?
No, I think you got the economics right. And I think if the public understood that their pension isn't really there, if they knew how underfunded Social Security was, if they understood how underfunded their pension was, they would be outraged. And yes, it's a fundamental rupture of the social contract. But the question is, what will people do about it? And I think there are two choices. One is, yeah, you can protest. You know, you can go to the streets, you can burn buildings down, but you know what? It won't cause your pension fund to be funded. It won't give you more money in Social Security. And people are intelligent, and they will go, you know what? There's only one other option, and that is to innovate. That is to build. That is to work longer. Already we see that folks over the age of 50 are not only working longer, but folks over 50 are re-entering the workforce at an incredibly rapid rate. And interestingly, they're not entering into the workforce in full-time positions with traditional corporations because those jobs aren't there for them. What they are doing is engaging in what we call the gig economy, where you work part of your time for a friend who's running an entrepreneurial venture, and you spend part of your time advising the company that you spent many years working for, and you spend a little bit of your time doing other things that generate some revenue. And people are building portfolios of activities, and I think they're doing it across a wide array of income levels. Like, you know, I was in the U.S. recently, and I had a wonderful black female taxi driver. She was an entrepreneur, and we started chatting, and she's talking. She's got a couple of kids. She's working for Uber, but she's trying to create a catering business. And she's practically explaining more to me about how the tax code messes her up than I think half the people at the IRS could do in explaining the U.S. tax code. And her determination is massive because her feeling is there is no other choice. Nobody else is going to look after me here. I have great confidence that the people that we assume might, you know, go to the streets and burn things down, among them, there will be some that do this. But actually, most people will want to find a way to grow and build our way out of this. And I see lots of indications that this is exactly what's happening. Technology is empowering this. I mean, if you look at a place like Detroit, which everybody completely wrote off as a disaster, actually, since they did the write-off of the debt, Detroit is on fire. Investments coming in. Businesses are succeeding again. It's an energy hotspot where people are going because of all the activity. So, I mean, you can have a very negative view. I just don't. I have a deep belief that Americans in particular are so hopeful that they will figure out how to innovate their way out of this. I mean, we may have our bumpy moments, but overall, this is not a country that goes up in flames. I wish I could say the same about continental Europe. I'm not as optimistic there.
Unfortunately, on that point, we are not only out of time, but considerably over time. Before we close, I just for our listeners who would like to follow more of your work, Harold, I know you write for a defense-oriented website. You also have a new book coming out this year that you're still writing. Tell us a little bit about how we can follow your work, as well as what's the new book about.
I write for a second line of defense, a website that is read by the military and the defense community throughout the world, the defense industry. And it's a small group of us who do it, but it includes some of the world's leading experts on what the defense industry is and how it functions and how it interrelates with governments. And it's pretty much the frontier of what's going on in what I believe to be a world arms race. It's probably the one of the real growth engines of the global economy, for good or bad. And I write sometimes for other places. For example, this last week, a Business Insider picked up an explanation I gave on how long it takes to set up a new administration, what are the mechanics of doing it, how does the Congress work, how does the president function, in which I said that it takes about a year to put an administration in place, no matter what your intentions are. There's no 100 days. So the book I'm writing is about the last 50 years. How did we get from where we were after the end of the Cold War to the mess we are in now? I've been involved in almost all of the phases, not only in the U.S., but with a number of other countries. So I think that might be interesting. But that is a process in work.
Thank you so much. And Pippa, you have a new book called Signals, which is all about this breakdown of the social contract. Tell us a little bit more about that, and also where else can our listeners follow your work?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I constantly put stuff up on Twitter and Facebook under the handle at Dr. Pippa M, because nobody could spell Malmgren. And I give examples of signals that I see all the time that tell me about what's going on in the world. It was one of the ways that I called the Trump landslide just before the actual vote. I saw, you know, all the people showing up at the rallies, and the polls had to be off. It just didn't make sense. So that's one place. I have a book out. It's called Signals, How Everyday Science Can Help Us Navigate the World's Turbulent Economy. And interestingly, the publishers in the U.S. said, your book is too international for an American audience. So in fact, you cannot get it on Amazon. What you can get is the Audible version that I personally recorded because I felt so passionately about the subject. And I also have another book called Geopolitics for Investors. It's a bit more technical about the geopolitics in the world economy, but these are the three ways that you can follow my work.
I should have mentioned that I also on Twitter, actually I'm active on Twitter, and the interaction is now becoming blossoming because I'm the only person on Twitter who's saying the politically incorrect things, that is explaining why the Fed is completely wrong. And I'm finding a surprising response, so many people saying, thank you for finally saying what I've been thinking. So I'm pretty productive or prolific, let's say, on Twitter, if anybody's interested in that.
And your Twitter handle?
Yeah, my Twitter handle is called Hal's Rethink, because my nickname over the years was Hal. But it's just, you know, rethinking what you see is may not be what's going on. Look a little deeper, and what you'll find is there's usually less there than meets the eye, and occasionally, sometimes, there'll be more there than meets the eye.
And on that note, we've got to end it there. Thank you so much for a fantastic interview. Aaron Chan and I will be back as Macro Voices continues in overtime right here at MacroVoices.com.
Macro Voices is a listener-driven program. please email requests for specific future interview guests to requests@macrovoices.com. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer them on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. We also welcome your suggestions for how we can improve the program. Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Aaron Chan.
Wow, amazing interview from the Malmgrens. You know, I've been looking forward to this interview for quite some time, and I'm so glad we were finally able to bring them together for our listeners. You know, it was such a great interview that we just had to let them run with it, and unfortunately, we won't be doing our usual post-game. So, Eric, anything else to add before we close?
I'm glad that we let it run, too, because I thought it was great content. And so in the interest of time, let's just get right to the point. We really need your help, folks. As you've noticed, we're getting some better and better interview guests as we had today. Aaron's got some fantastic people lined up for you for the rest of the fall lineup. So I think you're really going to enjoy the show in the next, through the end of the year. But in order to keep doing this, we really need your help. So please retweet us when we announce the show. Tell your friends about it. Forward your research roundup email to your friends and colleagues, and most importantly, register at macrovoices.com for your free account. Doesn't cost anything, only takes a few minutes to sign up, and the benefit is you will receive our free research roundup email, which every week contains links to all of the coolest free stuff that Aaron could find on the internet. This week, he's really knocking himself out. Aaron, what have we got for our registered users?
Well, since we're already way over our time budget for this week's show, you know, let me just throw some names at you. Kyle Bass, Howard Marks, Stan Druckenmiller, Carl Icahn, Sam Zell, Bill Gross, James Grant, and much more. Be sure to track down this week's research roundup for their latest reactions to the outcome of the presidential election and general market commentary. So that does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we've gotten, and continue to welcome your suggestions on how we can make this program even better. For our listeners who write or blog about global markets and would like to share that content with our pro-finance community, shoot us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com or tag it with the MVRR hashtag, and we'll include it in our weekly distribution. If you haven't already, follow our main Twitter account at macrovoices for the latest updates and interview releases. You can also follow Eric at Eric S. Townsend or myself at _AaronChan_. For Eric Townsend, I'm Aaron Chan. Chat with you next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Please register your free account at www.macrovoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly research roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week, which never includes advertising or marketing. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we're able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can also subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week, free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts, Eric Townsend and Aaron Chan, shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit macrovoices.com.